Good afternoon, Mr. Easy. How are you?
Very well, thank you, sir.
What sports coach do you like?
I'm a soccer fan, football fan.
And you've never been involved in boxing?
No, I know that it is famous for boxing, but I've shied away from the sport.
Do you know ex-killer?
Yes, I know him.
Was he using an axe to kill you?
No, he had such a powerful right hook that they called him, it seemed like we were axing people down. So they called him axe killer.
Are you by any way related to him apart from the clan name that you share?
No, just share the clan name.
Now, these are members of the subcommittee that is going to be interacting with you. And just as your opening gambit, so to speak, very, very briefly, if you tell them who you are.
As already indicated, my name is Ntantangeti and I come from KwaZulu-Natal. I am an attorney by profession, an admitted attorney, and I have quite a few years of experience in the civil service. Presently, I'm the special advisor to the Premier in KwaZulu-Natal, and before then, I was the Director General of the province in KwaZulu-Natal. I exited that job because the contract had come to an end. And before then, I was the regional head of SASA, the Social Security Agency. And before then, I worked for 6 years in the Scorpions as the head of the Crime Analysis Division. And before then, I've been a member of the KwaZulu-Natal Legislature for 8 years. And before then, I was a student. That's me.
What you are trying to do, and having started not just yesterday, but for quite some time, is for us to find someone who is going to be the next Inspector General of Intelligence. And from yesterday, of course, we had interviews and we continue with those interviews today. What, therefore, is going to happen is that these honorable members are going to be posing questions. I'll also now and again want to share certain things with you relating to your responses. And in the main, they are going to deal with the law that relates to oversight. But they'll also be able to go to the Constitution because this position is covered in our Constitution. There are other things because we are going to assess you on the basis of suitability. And suitability, therefore, does not only relate to the relevant law. It also talks to other things that are necessary in respect of characterizing the person we need to be an Inspector General of Intelligence. And that is going to come from these members that you see in front of you. And of course, it will be very helpful if, as you respond to their questions, that your answers are straight and to the point, so that we do not have a situation where you go round and round and round before you come to the answer that is sought, particularly because in the process we may lose you. We may not understand what you are saying. We want to avoid that. And you know, at times when you talk about this thing, we don't want a situation where we ask you, what is a spade? And you tell us that a spade is that implement that you use in order for us to dig holes and what have you. Because we won't understand that there are so many other implements that are used to dig holes. We want you to be brief and to the point. Now, honorable members, here is the next candidate. May I see your hands? We start with Kosana, followed by Sifako, and followed by, let me go straight down there, followed by Honorable Steven, sorry.
Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Honorable Funeval.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Mr. Ngidi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, sir.
Honorable Chairperson, let me start by saying to Mr. Ngidi, an office of an IGI, it was almost having no leader for a year. Now, I want to know the plans that you can come with to make sure that the office is operational. That's question number one. Number two, section 7.7, paragraph B, refers to the review of intelligence and counterintelligence activities of any service. What is your understanding of the review of the activities of any services, and which services would be included in any services? Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, respond.
No, thank you for the question. Of course, I'm quite aware that the office has not been without it, has been without a leader for more than a year now. So I believe that there would be a number of things that one would have to get right. The first thing, of course, would be to see whether the strategic plans and the operational plans are still relevant. We would have to review that, because having not operated without a strategic leader for quite some time, it is possible that they may have veered off what they had planned before. And of course, it would be to also to look at the suitability of those who are occupying critical posts within the office to see whether they need further empowerment, training, and stuff like that, and also to see whether there are any critical posts that are vacant which would need to be filled to ensure that the office operates optimally. Those would be the areas that I would look at, and of course I would have to look at the work that they have been doing to see whether the work does fall in line with the mandate of the office as such, whether they have been in a position to be able to play the oversight role that the office is supposed to play whilst they did not have a leader. And where I can see that there are gaps, well, we'll have to ensure that those gaps are filled in as soon as possible. The area of section 7, subsection 7, I understand a review as looking at the work that is being done by the intelligence services and reviewing it to see whether the work that has been done is in tune with the legal prescripts, setting, of course, with the Constitution, the relevant acts and the regulations and whatever policies that there may be within the organization. It is something that you do as a matter of course.
my understanding of the law is that the Inspector General is expected to review the work as a matter of course. When the reports have been done, then those reports should be submitted to the Inspector General for him to ensure that the reports, the work that has been done, is in keeping with the mandate of that intelligence service, and the manner in which it has been done is in keeping with the constitution and the laws of this country.
Next. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Mr. Ndizi. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
In your letter that you have written to us, you say that you successfully bring down corruption in the KwaZulu-Natal government by more than 60%. What model did you employ to achieve that task? That's the first question. Secondly, I went through your curriculum detail, and then I discovered that as a director general of the province, one of the tasks is to ensure that the financial management or the annual report of the financial performance of the province and all departments are up to date. Now, looking at that experience, I am of the understanding that you are queued up with the Public Audit Act of 2004. What will be your opinion or suggestion or amendment should you be appointed as an Auditor General to that act, so as to ensure that as an inspector general, so as to ensure that the Auditor General executes his task within the parameters of the Constitution, since the environment that will be in, it has got tasks that are covered in the other operations. So I need your contribution towards that. I've gone through your movement from you know, I'm looking at the date there, from this date to that date. Now, and I've seen that on the 1st of June 2009 to the 31st of May 2010, you served there for 1 year. And you are saying you were promoted to a position of a provincial director general. Now, that's the most senior position in every notion within government. Getting promoted, would you say, was the proper procedural way of being given that position? Or whoever appointed you was supposed to follow a particular procedural policies to ensure that the position is being made available to all people that might be interested to apply? Is that real that you were promoted? Now, you have also indicated, that's the third question, you have also indicated to us that responsible for ensuring proper management of grant administration in the region, efficient management of grant transfer in KwaZulu-Natal. Should you be the Inspector General, what skills, financial skills, that you're going to add to this office to ensure that the public purse complaint given to you, referring to whether it be mismanagement or it could be whatever complaint, but in relation to the to the sisters of the family, how are you going to apply the experience you gained during this time to that situation? I thank you.
Thank you very much, ma'am, for the questions. Yes, during my tenure of office as Director General in the office of the Premier, corruption did come down quite a lot. What I did was to change the office, which was at the time known as the Department of Fraud Management. And I then said, no, you don't manage fraud, you eliminate fraud. And then I changed the office into the Office of Integrity Management. Now, integrity management means more than just fraud management. It means also applying, also looking at the mindset of the public servants and ensuring that they adopt the correct mindset to be able to do their work honestly. I also then, together with the then Premier of the province, then ensured that there was ethical training for senior members from level 13 upwards, that there was ethical training. We employed a renowned ethicist by the name of Professor Goba, who is passed away about a month ago. We employed his services to draw up a curriculum for the province for the training of senior management in issues of ethics. And we then also started a campaign that went throughout the 10 districts of the province. The campaign, I introduced a theme. Before the campaign, we convened what we called leadership integrity conference, where all of us as public servants came to one venue, and one of the things that we did was to commit ourselves in writing to the fact that we will ensure that we act honestly and with integrity in our doing things in KwaZulu-Natal. The theme of that conference, which is the theme that I introduced into the province, was that I do right even when nobody's watching. We then took that theme and turned it into a campaign that we then went throughout the province of throughout the 10 districts of the province, and the campaign was I Do Right campaign. That campaign is still ongoing even now, and it takes many forms, but the main thing is to ensure that people understand that, because we are addressing the mindset that as public servants, they don't need administrative measures in order for them to work honestly. They themselves must be their own police. So this is part of that campaign, because what we said is that the campaign should be, we said that the campaign should have three elements. The first element of that campaign is for all civil servants to commit themselves to working honestly. Secondly, the second element was to call to service providers not to bribe public servants, to assure them that even if they did not pay price, they would still get work from government, And the third element was that whoever then gets to know of any unethical practices by anybody within the province should then report that. We then set up a provincial hotline which is connected to the presidential hotline. These are the activities, these are the methods that we employ in order to ensure that we bring down corruption within KwaZulu-Natal. We went further than that. We did not just involve the office of the premier, but we involved all offices, whether they report nationally or report provincially, and formed and revived a structure. Which is known as a corruption commission, which meets once a year, chaired by the Director General of the province. And that structure is supposed to monitor the implementation of the conference decisions. You remember that we convened a leadership integrity conference. Now, the structure of that, this structure that I'm talking about, is supposed to monitor the implementation of those resolutions that were taken in that conference, because the conference that we're looking at was going to be a conference that was going to take place every 2 years. That conference is taking place every 2 years within KwaZulu-Natal, and it is because of all those measures that we were able, therefore, to get corruption, to lower incidents of corruption within KwaZulu-Natal. Of course, we work closely with the police, we work closely with the SIU and other law enforcement agencies to ensure, because it's not just about changing the mindset, but also to ensure that those who do not want to change the mindset, they even stick at the end. Then the issue of the financial management. I think one would have to study the practices within the office that have to do with issues of SCM, how that is done, so that if there are any changes that need to be done, then what would have to effect those changes. Of course, the PFMA, Public Finance Management Act, is our guiding document as managers. So one would have to ensure that there is complete compliance with the principles with the provisions of the PFMA. And of course, from time to time, you get prescripts, treasury prescripts, and those are the prescripts that should guide the way in which we manage the finances of whatever office in which we work. And as long as our practices are in compliance with all these prescripts, then there shouldn't be a problem. It's just to ensure that this happens. Of course, what needs to happen is that there should be a financial management meeting of every month, where you look at the performance of every unit within the office to ensure that everybody works in compliance with the law. With respect to my movement from SASA to the DG, though it's written promotion, it's not promotion in the true sense in that I was sort of picked up from the office to PDG. No, there was a post of the Director General that was advertised in the normal way that it's advertised. I applied and I underwent a very rigorous interview. And not only was I interviewed by the MECs and the Premier in the province, but I was even tested for proficiency by an independent organization, which then gave a green light that I was suitable for the job. So it's not promotion in the sense that left movement, but it's promotion in the sense that I moved from level 15 to level 16. Yeah, with regard to the financial skills to ensure that the public purse is looked after correctly, I think my answer is the same, in that all that you ensure is compliance. Once there is absolute compliance with the law, once there is absolute compliance with the provisions of the PFMA, I don't think you can go wrong.
No, thank you, Chairperson. No, actually, what I wanted to find out is how then do you see, based on what you're saying, as far as financial management or public purse is concerned, how do you see then the relationship of the Inspector General's office with the Auditor General when it comes to the annual report, because he needs to give you an opinion on that?
Well, I think the relationship between the office and that and the Auditor General will take place in the same manner in which the Auditor General relates with other departments. Of course, taking into account the nature of the work that the Office of the Inspector General does, the Auditor General will have to look at our strategy, you have to look at our operational plan and look at the way in which our budgeting plan and ensure that these do correspond, and if then they correspond, to ensure that we have followed every legal prescript in by way of spending. We have not yet away from spending, that there's proper authorization for all expenditure, and also to ensure that there are no wasteful or fruitless expenditure within the department and within the office. And if those things are then ensured, I don't think that there should be a problem between the Inspector General and the Auditor General. The way things are done is that you sit down with the Auditor General and have a discussion beforehand, and you agree on how the relationship between the two offices is going to unfold, taking into account, of course, as I have indicated, the uniqueness and the peculiarities of the office of the Inspector General.
At the moment, I have the following honorable members. I have Sfako, Groenewald, and Kamede. Kumede has ended up so, okay, let me start afresh. I have now the four honorable members there, Sifako, Stebe, Groenewald, Ngwabe, and Kumede. Then Kamede will be the last voice. Okay?
Thank you very much, honorable chair, and good time of the day. Commendable or congratulations for having made sure that at least 60% you reduce the corruption in TSD. Really, that's commendable. The question here is, South Africa is faced with a very similar challenge of illicit economy, illicit mining. You also go to the financial institutions where you have the cyber crime, the card cloning, all that, the financial outflow and the tax evasion. With the wealth of expertise that you have bring, how best can you
intervene in Shori, maybe repeating the very same strategy that you used in reducing the crime, the corruption pool was 60% in this field of intelligence. Maybe lastly, to be a very brief, drawing a distinction between public interest and the national interest. Thank you very much, Chair.
Mr.
Ngidi.
Thank you. Yeah, I would agree with honorable members of FACO that as a country we are facing quite a serious problem of corruption. That we, even when I draw from my experience as I worked within the Scorpions as the head of crime analysis, it was quite apparent then that organized crime, particularly cyber crime, was a serious threat. And that threat has not abated. It's still a serious threat even now. I think the first thing that needs to be done is to equip your investigators with the necessary skills of understanding the threat of understanding the threat. Secondly, it is to ensure that there is a part of the problem is that once we are facing the threat, we don't have a common repository of information or intelligence that is reliable enough for us to be able to point a finger as to what would be the solution. I think it is important that as a country we begin to address that, to ensure that there is a common repository in the country of intelligence, of information, which would enable us to reliably be able to pinpoint where the problem is. And I think, therefore, as Inspector General, one would like to influence that kind of understanding within the intelligence services. Part of the problem, of course, even within the intelligence services, is the problem of turf wars. And if we could then ensure that we address that problem, I'm sure we would be able to defeat the problem of the problem that the honourable member has alluded on. But I think also it is important that there be broad education of the people of this country. And I therefore feel that as part of the work that one would have to do, because it would have to engage the people in terms of education, engagement to educate them about these threats, so that the community at grassroots level understands these threats and can then become your early warning, be part of your early warning system to, as these crimes unfold, because without them being engaged, without them being educated into the crimes, without them being conscientized, as it were, about some of these goings on, there will be therefore always be a gap between those who are supposed to enforce the law and those that are supposed to be assisted by the law enforcers. The difference between public and national interest, I think that one is a bit of a difficult one. I would just, this is my own individual opinion, think that public interest is not very far from national interest, but that national interest would refer to those matters that which speak to the areas of consensus, if there are any, within the nation. For instance, education would be a national, it would be issue of national interest. The defense of the borders of this country would be an issue of national interest. Public interest would then speak to those issues that are of a social nature, which if they are catered for, speak to the comfort of the public. Your civic issues, for instance, whether the availability of water, the good roads, are the good roads in the community, that for me would be issues that would refer as matters of public interest. But in terms of treating both, I think they need to be treated with importance because both of them are quite important. And it is for a matter of public interest to change into a matter of national interest.
Next.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just one quickly one thing is maybe I missed it, but if. If you can just tell me, what did you do from 31st of May month 2015 when your contract expired till the 10th of the 6th month when you were, I can't find it in yet, that's the one thing. Then, section 788 determined that the IG shall have access to any intelligence information or premises under the control of any service in such access, if such access is required by the IG for the performance of his or her functions and may demand such intelligence, information and reports and explanations as the IGI may deem necessary of the performance of his or her functions. Now the question is, does this section entitle the IGI to have access to all covert intelligence information or any premises used by the services in covert activities, particularly in the light of section 7AB? And the other question is, would the committee be entitled to have access to such reports containing information that may not be disclosed in terms of section 7AB3 if it is determined to be detrimental to the national interest to disclose? That's the one.
Thank you. Thank you, Honourable Member, Mr. Staff. well, from the 31st of May 2015 to the 10th of June 2016, I was not employed. My contract came to an end on the 31st of May, and it was not renewed. I would not know the reason for it not being renewed because that's the prerogative of the Premier, to renew or not to renew the contract. So I then stayed at home. I was unemployed, as it were, and I then sort of tried to survive by doing odd jobs, as it were. But then on the 10th of June, I was then reappointed into the office of the Premier as the Premier's advisor. I think the law itself entitles the Inspector General to have access to all intelligence information. Otherwise, if that is not the case, it would be difficult to monitor compliance. Even if it means just a little bit of that information, it would be difficult because at a particular point in terms of the law, the Inspector General must give a certificate to the minister relevant. Now, how can you then give a certificate? So that certificate says to the minister that the intelligence service in question has complied with the law. You then can only be able to give that certificate when you know what was the product. And I think that is why, therefore, from the IG, it's got to have top secret clearance from SSA, so that you are a person that can be entrusted with the secrets of this country. From time to time, you've got to give, and I don't see where one could draw a line on the information that should be given to this committee and the information that should not be given to this committee. I think that is a matter that, for me, is a straightforward matter. If this is a committee on intelligence, and by law, if I were to be appointed to be an Inspector General, by law, I am supposed to be giving a report to this committee. I can't come to this committee and give half reports.
Are these follow-up questions?
Yes, I've got a follow-up.
Start with you because you asked the question.
Thank you. Sir, if what you were saying now is, I follow what you said, but I want to link it with your success that you had in KZN, where you curb corruption with more than 60%. Now, seeing that you're working in an environment where there's undercover things, and you are looking at information, and you must see whether the information correlates with the plan and the finances of what is budgets, whatever is there. Don't you think it will be really a difficult situation for you to try to curb corruption in areas which is not that accessible? And what plan do you foresee to bring into this with you if you should get a position to see if you can curb corruption? What are you going to implement? Because you are the Office of the Inspector General, and there's a Director General let's talk only SSA. There's, for the SSA, there's a Director General. If you go to the other entities, there's ministers that you have to also have to take in cognizance. How will you implement that? Thank you.
One of the guiding principles of the work of the Inspector General is partnership, is to ensure that you establish partnership with even the people that you must exercise oversight. Therefore, there should be an engagement. Even before anything happens, there should be an engagement between the Inspector General and the Director General of, let's say, SSA, or the two SSAs, whether local or the international one. And of course, those who are responsible for intelligence in the police and the army. There should be form of, in my understanding, there should be form of regular interaction, so that you then understand issues of corruption in the same way. And therefore, whatever program that you come up with should be a program that is also acceptable to these other senior officials, so that you don't want to, as an inspector general, you don't want that when you take a step in terms of curbing corruption, that step is not in sync with the other managers. That would be the critical issue that we'd have to address. Of course, there is issue, as I indicated, that this is what one did in KwaZulu-Natal. There is also the issue of ethical training. I know a number of managers do not understand the importance of ethical training. I always say that as a Christian, I go to church every day. I know the Bible from Exodus to Revelation, but I still see the need of going to church every day. That's the kind of attitude that one must inculcate within those who are working in the civil service in terms of their approach to ethical training, that even though you may not be unethical, it's still important to undergo that ethical training, because what you are looking at is not just to give people knowledge about what they need to do in order to operate ethically, but to engender an atmosphere which is inimical to corrupt practices.
You have indicated that one of the instruments you would use to deal with corruption would be a very close system of interaction with the relevant departments. The obvious question then is, what design would you put in place for that interaction to unearth corruption? Because you can have regular interaction with various kinds of people, but it does not respond directly to the question of corruption. How, in your regular interaction, do you then unearth corruption? What kind of instrument, mechanism, for instance, that you would put in place in order for you in that regular interaction to unearth corruption?
If it is not in existence, there should be a special unit that is set up to look in these matters, which is also trained specifically to ensure that you deal with issues of corruption, which ensures that it sets up standards such as would ensure that whoever is operational within the services does so within certain set standards, which would then ensure that particular practices cannot and do not happen within those services. I believe that if one came up with that kind of mechanism, it would assist to ensure that you unearth corruption. But I think also we should not forget that there are already other mechanisms, for instance your vetting mechanisms, which attempt to disclose areas of vulnerability within an individual. Therefore, if you then pay close attention to your members of staff, to the reports that come from the vetting, to those who are doing vetting, and ensure that you assist those members in those areas which have been identified as areas of vulnerability, and you do that jointly I think that would help quite a lot in terms of fighting corruption. Because at the end of corruption, at the end of it all, corruption starts in the mind. And until we have addressed that, we are not going to be able to fight it.
Because of the covert nature of some aspects of the work of intelligence, right through the intelligence community, there are areas, one of the honorable members raised that question. It was Honorable Stepper. He says, because of the covert nature of the operations of the within the intelligence community, it becomes difficult at times to break through that wall for you to have an understanding of what happens beyond that wall, some of which can easily be corrupt. And the Auditor General has designed some instrument to deal with that, but it relates to human nature to some extent, because it has to do with certain levels of assurance. Now, what would you do were you to be appointed an Inspector General of Intelligence in a situation where there's a need for absolute assurance with respect to those matters of a covert nature? In the event there is resistance within the relevant department, what would you do? Because you want to be assured that there is no shenanigans that happens behind the curtain. What would you do?
Yeah, that's a complicated one. But in my opinion, it boils down to the relationships that, as the Inspector General, we are able to generate between yourself as Inspector General and the DGs of the relevant intelligence offices. But I think because once there is corruption in any intelligence office or services, once there's corruption there, that should be taken as a national threat on its own. Because you can't have a service that looks at what we don't normally see as normal human beings, and you then have issues of corruption coming up. They should therefore be, if it is not longer there, if it is not there already, one would then recommend to the relevant authorities that under certain requirements, there should be a lifting of the veil of covertness if you want to ensure that you address issues of corruption. But that should be done within certain specifications.
I have Honorable Smith, followed by Honorable Funabad, Honorable Mwade, Honorable Kumede, Honorable Gala, and Honorable Wana. I hope by the time we get to Honorable Wana, we shall have completely won out on this one, right? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You will, of course, appreciate that from where I sit, that being the special advisor to the Premier and the Director General in the office of the Premier could create an impression that I wouldn't use the word state capture, but there's executive capture, let's put it that way. But so there's a concern that you, in your way of thinking and your reasoning, would tend to favour executive rather than the legislative, and in particular JSCI, at point of departure, because it depends on point of departure, how you see your role. So in, with that in mind, my question basically relates to the how you see the Act, because if you say that the Act, if the Act provides this, then I will do that. But my question is, in particular response to Mr. Stubber, was that if the Act, I think your response was, if the Act says I am compelled to do so, I will do so. My question is basically, how do you see the Act in respect of your responsibility, your legal responsibility, when the President has tasked you, I think there's a legal term for it, if the President designated a function to the IGI, that's the use of the phrase, you then have to provide the President with a report. But in your view, is it also legally, are you legally bound to also provide the JHI with the report? Because in the process, in answering, there is section 7 sub 6, which says you are accountable to the JHI. Now this gives a bit of a qualification, that's why I'm raising this, because it says that in the instance where a President delegates a function, that you then provide with the report and the relevant ministers. So my question basically, do you in your legal function see an obligation you to provide the JHI with, in both instances, with reports? And then secondly, the issues which are addressed in the report in terms of section 7A, which says that the reports of the IGI submitted in terms of section 7A in respect of monitoring and reviewing, that is your main function, monitoring and reviewing, shall contain the findings and recommendations of the IGI. So you need to make findings, and then you need to make recommendations. What is your legal understanding as to whether the services are bound, just like with the public protector, to the recommendations you would be making if you were appointed? Do you think recommendations are just there for taking notes, and if you wish to become a follow-up, or are they legally bound to follow those recommendations? Because we've had candidates saying yes,
and saying no. So I'd like your view. Before you respond, switch off the TV. I'm sure you are aware that he did not say you bow to executive authority on the basis of your previous employment. But what he is saying is, in the mind of a person, given those responsibilities, you might therefore have the tendency to do certain things that would impact on your role as an Inspector General. I'm raising this so that you do not go at length trying to justify your having been in those positions. Because the key question is, indeed, in the mind of an ordinary person, when you say someone has worked there for so long, you would want to believe that that person does bow to executive authority. And therefore, will this person be able to use their own mind to deal with these things, some of which, in fact, would challenge some of those in an executive authority?
Yeah, let me just start by saying that for 8 years I was a member of the provincial legislature in KwaZulu-Natal.
That is making me more worried.
And I therefore understand very clearly the importance of the legislature and its subcommittee. I think that would be my starting point. Therefore, I come with this knowledge into the office if I am the preferred candidate, come with this background of understanding both worlds, if I could use that term. Secondly, I think the law is very clear in terms of the lines of reporting, that I am bound by the law report to this committee. And I did say earlier on that I don't envisage a situation where I come with to this committee with half of the information. Because my reading of the law does not tell me that. Therefore, I understand that yes, the president would give me some tasks to do. That those tasks, are, in my understanding, are in the nature of my work. And when I come to report to this committee, I give reports of activities that I've done in the nature of my work. That would be, therefore, my answer to your first question. No, the question that findings and recommendations, how do I see the distinction? Recommendations are recommendations. They can either be accepted or not accepted. So so they are sort of loose in their nature. But findings should be based on certain things, either the law or the facts, and therefore it would mean, it would presuppose that whoever makes the findings would have done an in-depth investigation of the matter in order to be to come to a point where one gives a finding. Therefore, I don't think that findings, if the Office of the Inspector General makes a finding, those findings can be easily swept away. If the Inspector General then says, in my investigation of the of a particular matter, these are the findings that I have made, I believe that particularly those that I will be reporting to are then duty bound to ensure that those findings are acted upon.
Is that a follow-up?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. In order to make recommendations, you need to make findings, factual findings, I would guess, and then you make a recommendation. You can find that something, a factual position existed, you can find that someone contravened a law or regulation or whatever provincial gazette, but you need to make a recommendation following from that. And it's the recommendation that's concerned, not the finding is fine, the recommendation as to the, because if you found that there are certain findings where you said it said A has contravened, the recommendation should be in line with those findings, and the question then arises as to the how binding are those recommendations when they are based on, let's say, a non-adherence to regulations or acts or laws. But on the second issue, and the issue where I wanted to interpose, which has now escaped and
if it was not part of the follow-up.
It was part of the follow-up, but I'm just thinking as to what it was, because, yes, that was the point. There's a difference between reporting to the JACI and providing a report which is given to the President and the Minister to the JACI. It may sound like linguistic architecture or elastic exercise, but reporting to means I report to the committee that I have undertaken the following investigations. That's reporting to, without providing necessarily a copy of the report. My question is, more specific is, if you provide the minister with a report, if you provide the president with a report, like I've indicated a while ago, are you bound to provide that report to the committee? With that distinction in mind, your answer.
Okay. My simple answer would be, why not?
We are not going to have a dialogue here.
Yes.
We are not going to have a dialogue. Also, don't ask him. Just answer.
No, sorry for that, Chairperson. I don't see the difference really. Because whatever report that I would give to the president, perhaps what would determine anything would be the matter of sequence. Where should the report go first? But I don't see the difference in that. I don't see the problem in the report ending up within the committee. But there would be an issue of sequence. If the president gave me a task, and I mean the first person I should report to would be the president, then we would maybe together also ensure that that report then comes to the this committee.
There was a third question. Can you respond to that?
I'm sorry. The report, the recommendations. Yes, you do findings and then you make recommendations. I think once those recommendations are made, really from my side, it would then have to be the because I make the recommendations to this committee, to the committee that I report to. I think if the office of the Inspector General is held in high esteem, those recommendations themselves would have to be treated with all the seriousness they deserve, because they are not made lightly, they are made after an investigation. So one would expect that those recommendations then are acted upon. If they are not acted upon, they should be given good reason why they are not.
Honorable Khunewal.
Thank you, Chairperson. My questions were not so difficult. I think it is more easy. But a lot of these sections are interlinked with each other, and therefore, Honorable Schmidt also touched on this one. Section 7.7c refers to the performance of all functions designated to him or her by the president or any minister for a service. Now my question is, what is your understanding of the type of functions that may lawfully be designated to you by the president or the minister of any service? That is my first question, and then I have a second one as well, as Chairperson, and that is, you also mentioned how you manage your offices in KwaZulu-Natal. But what I want to hear from you, what will be your management style in this office, specifically in this office of the IG? And also, how are you going to handle the challenges you have in this office? Thank you.
Mr. Ngidi.
Thank you. Yes, my understanding of the matters that would be referred to me, I think it can take any form the matter that the president decides to refer to the Inspector General. It must be a matter that is intelligence related. Perhaps the president let's say that the president is unhappy with certain things that are happening in one intelligence service or the other, or a number of them, then refers that matter to the Inspector General for investigation, and then, of course, eventually making recommendations to him as to how he should then act with respect to those matters. And I think the same thing applies to the minister. It's more like when the minister speaks, perhaps the minister may feel that a particular matter that would have arisen in the intelligence services would best be referred to the inspector general. Remember that the inspector general is supposed to be independent of the intelligence services. Therefore, there would be instances where either the president or the minister would want to engage an independent entity to look into matters, so that they are assured that whatever a report back they get is objective and is a report back that does not take sides in any way. I think that would be the issues where they are looking at and to utilize the independence of the Inspector General to ensure that they arrive at the correct decision with respect to a matter. My management style is that basically I believe in ensuring that those who work with me optimize their capabilities. I don't believe in micromanagement. I don't believe in micromanaging the department. We set the rules and regulations, and then all that I then look for is that we have complied with what we agreed upon as the manner in which we're going to do our work. So if we don't comply, then of course there would be consequences for that. But if we comply, then well and good. So that would be that basically is my management style. I'm sorry, Honourable Member, for forgetting the last question.
The last one is challenges. Or
challenges. Well, having not been in the office of the Inspector General, I would not really be in the know as to what challenges that there are. But I'm expecting to find many, because the office has not been without a leader for quite some time. And the first thing, therefore, that one would have to do would be to understand the nature of the challenges. What is it? What really the challenges? What are their nature? So that you then ensure that you apply correct remedies for whatever challenges that there may be. It could be challenges of discipline. Therefore, one would have to strengthen on issues of discipline and apply the policies of the office to ensure that there is proper discipline within the office. It could be challenges of mismanagement of funds. One would have to look into that and ensure that one applies proper remedies for that in order to address that kind of problem. So the main thing is just to begin to understand the challenges and understand the climate within which one is operating, so that when one then applies whatever remedies, those are appropriate remedies.
Honorable Nwabe, thank you, Chair. Greetings to Mr. Gideon.
Thank you.
I've got only two questions. One relates to conflict resolution in the workplace. Say you get appointed or recommended for the office. Obviously, as you have said, you meet different people there working under you. And in any workplace, conflict do arise. So one wants to get your experience in conflict resolution. I know I've been in management, I've seen your CV, but can you really take us to confidence in terms of conflict resolution? Lastly, will be to check whether have you experienced any finding against you in relation to mismanagement of resources in your position. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mwale. Well, I have been in instances where one had to undertake conflict resolution. And of course, the basic principle in any conflict resolution is to listen to both sides and ensure that everybody gets fair chance of representing himself or herself. And then you make a finding based on that. If there are witnesses that need to be brought into the matter, then you bring them into the matter. Of course, I that is my approach. Perhaps it is also informed by the fact that I'm a lawyer. Therefore, I then apply those skills even in those matters where I ensure that ensures that there is fair representation of everybody concerned within within a dispute or a conflict. But at the end of the day, I must take a decision, and that decision must then be informed by what comes out from the conflict resolution, and perhaps as the final arbiter within the department in any matter, that I would regard that my decision then becomes final. Then whoever is aggrieved by that decision would have to then take it to other organs, following, of course, the labor relations route. So that would be my approach. Whether I have been found guilty of mismanagement in my previous engagement, the answer is no. I have a clean record as far as I've been working. I've never been even taken to a disciplinary hearing, let alone having an adverse finding against me.
Honorable Gumede.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. And good afternoon, Mr. Ngidi.
Good afternoon, sir.
My question will be around Section 7.7a, around the function of monitoring in the office of the Inspector General. The picture that I have of Mr. Ngidi, Honorable Chairperson, is that we are having an accomplished implementer. That is my picture. That is what seems to me to be. But I would like to check, given his international exposure, what were the lessons?
What exposure?
International exposure. If you refer to his covering letter on page 2, there is a numbering, number 6. Number 6, he says, representing the DFO in the international meetings and forums where information stroke intelligence of crime would be discussed. That is the international exposure I'm referring to. And then it is in line with functions of monitoring. I don't know whether I should continue on another question.
Continue, we are listening.
Okay, thank you, Honorable Chairperson. In fact, I would like to know, firstly, around monitoring mechanisms. What lessons have you learned in the exposure in terms of monitoring mechanisms? 2, in terms of stakeholder relationships, particularly around senior leadership. How do you engage and make sure that the findings and recommendations are in line with your mandate? Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Kumete. Well, lessons learned are that it is very important to engage all the stakeholders in who are active in the same line of work in which you are, and as you engage them, to always have an open mind, not to go into that engagement with preconceived ideas, because every engagement, as I've come to realize, is a learning experience, even for you and for, and of course for all that are involved in that kind of engagement. Now, what I've also learned is that every entity, in terms of the way that they do things, they are informed by the, of course, the circumstances, the unique circumstances of their country. And you've got, therefore, to be careful, even as you agree, because as South Africa, we are a country that has put quite a lot of premium on issues of human rights. In fact, I think as the Inspector General office, we are the only office where it is expressly said that your oversight role is to ensure compliance with the Constitution. In other jurisdictions, it is not said as expressly. It is not put as expressly as it is done in this country. Therefore, you should also then appreciate that you therefore have certain peculiarities that you've got to take into account as you engage with these as the stakeholders. And I think in developing the relations is always to make space for the next person, for that person to feel, to not feel that you think your line of approach is more important than his or her line of approach, that you are accommodating of their views as an entity. And these are the lessons that one has learned in those kinds of engagements.
Honorable Kamede, followed by Honorable Wana. And I said that would be the last of the honorable members that I'll call upon.
Thanks, Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Gedi.
Good afternoon, sir.
For Pattern, just two questions. In the CD, on page 1, on your special section, there's an unfilled gap. Where you talk about the University of Natal 1980 and you don't fill in anything from 1990 until which year were you there? Was that by design or omission? Secondly, you know, the Constitution and also the Intelligence Services Oversight Act says, I'm asking this differently from what my colleagues have asked, the Inspector General will be accountable and address the word accountable to the JETI, and responsible, and I stress the word responsible, to the president and relevant minister. Do you find any, how do you identify a difference in those two, accountability and responsibility? Thank you.
Well, with regard to the first question, Honorable Kamete, I was at the University of Zululand from 1972 to 1976. I couldn't finish my degree then because then there were the Soweto uprisings. As the university, we then had our own uprisings at the university, the consequence of which I was arrested, detained under the security laws at the time. When we went on trial, which lasted for over a year, fortunately one was acquitted. I then, I think from 1976 to middle 1977. I then worked for Mr. Mkhwanga, Griffith Mkhwanga, the later ten, and at the end of 1977, I was again arrested and detained and charged under the security laws and released in the middle of 1979. Between 1979 and beginning of 1980, I then went back to Mr. Mkhwanga's office to work as a clerk there. And in 1980, I then enrolled at the University of Natal. But 1980, I couldn't finish again because I then went into exile in June of that year and stayed in exile until I returned after the unbanning of the banned organization. So I think that explains the gap between then. And of course, whilst I was in exile, I decided to finish my education. I enrolled at the University of Zimbabwe, where I then had the opportunity to then acquire my LLB honors degree, which as it appears in my curriculum vitae. Accountability, in my understanding, is something that you have to do. Once you are said you are accountable to a particular structure, a particular person, you have no option but to give that person whatever that person needs in terms of you fulfilling your mandate of accountability. Being responsible does not mean really accountable in the sense that I would not go to the minister on a daily basis and account blow by blow on the work that I do. But I am responsible to the minister in the sense that as the Inspector General for Intelligence, the minister may call on me to provide certain services. And because of that relationship, I then become responsible because the minister is responsible for all intelligence. And therefore, I'm therefore responsible to provide whatever services that the minister may require from me. That would be the understanding
of and the distinction that I would have in my mind between accountability. I'm accountable to this. I would be accountable to this office, to this standing, to this committee. It is something. It is a duty that I have to at least, in terms of the law, if I'm selected, in terms of the law, every quarter, I can't do anything else. If I don't do that, then I can't be, it means that I'm not doing my work. And it means, therefore, I could be fired. But responsibility is just being called to certain things. I don't have to account to the minister that I did not go to the office on such and such a day. It's only I am responsible in terms of those tasks that the minister may refer to me.
In other words, with regard to this committee, we can say to you, submit your annual report here. But your view is that the minister has no right to demand that annual report to you, from you.
No, the minister can ask for the report. But
have you demand? We can demand. Can
he? No, he can't demand. That's not my understanding, that he can demand. But this committee, I have no option but to give the report because it's part of what has to happen. I am accountable to the committee. The committee must know what I do on a daily basis.
When the honorable member was asking this question, I was thinking, is he maybe trying to get you to become a Winston Churchill, a latter-day Winston Churchill? You remember when he appeared in Parliament and he said to an opposition member that he was lying. And of course, he was ruled out of order for saying that. And he was asked to withdraw. So he changed and said, the honorable member is guilty of terminological inexactitude. I thought he was trying to get you to say that. Honorable one.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've got one question. Let me say one plus. And my first question, according to Chairperson, my question is saying, according to the CV in page 5, Mr. Ngidi was the head of crime analysis division. My question is, if he's given this opportunity of leading that office, how is he going to spread in terms of trying to have a space in the corporate intelligence? When I'm saying corporate intelligence, person, I mean the CFI, financial service affairs. Secondly, if Ms. Tengit, can you tell me what is your understanding about the types of the functions that are lawfully designated to you by the president? Are you going to have the capacity to say, no, this function is not going to bring the country in a very integrity situation? Thank you, Chairperson.
In other words, you are saying, if he has a sense that the particular assignment is being given does not fit well with the mandate he has. Is that what you are asking?
Yes.
What will he do? Okay.
Yeah. With respect to the first question of Honorable Luana, I think the law is quite clear in that as Inspector General for Intelligence, my
oversight role is with respect to the four intelligence services within the country. It does not then mention other services. But I don't think that one would have to limit oneself to those services that are mentioned, because when it comes to matters of intelligence, every piece of information is important. And you would find that, particularly if you are looking at issues of cybercrime, at commercial crimes, at intelligence relating to commercial crimes and other such crime forms, the information that sits with your corporate intelligence, be it SAPRC, the banking structure, be it FSB, be it whoever, that information is critical. I think in that sense, one would have to then enter into an arrangement, be it an MOU or whatever, with these structures, which would then govern the relationship between the Office of the Inspector General and these other institutions that are not mentioned in the Act. That would be some, even structure like that, it would be very important for the Office of the Inspector General to have a structured relationship with them. MOU is the best, or SLA, whatever, however you would like to call it, is the best course of action. So I would then, if I'm selected, I would then go and ensure that I then set up these agreements, so that you then also have access even to the information of those agencies that may not be necessarily mentioned within the law. I can't imagine why a president would want me to do something illegal. But if that would happen, I believe that I've got the law on my side. And whether you are a president, a minister, or whatever, I can't do something that is illegal. If the law does not permit me to engage in certain instances, for instance, let me just say that there is a feeling these days that there is a use of state apparatus for political ends. It's there in the papers, everybody's talking about it. I personally can't see myself being party to that, because I'm here to serve the people of South Africa, irrespective of their political lineage or allegiance.
Thank you.
Honorable Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the position not, if you look at section, following from what you said just now, is the section not, well, the position not that in terms of section 77F, where you are designated by the president for fuller function, you shall, that means you must, you don't have an option, you must report to the president. In the instance where a report, in the annual report, that's a different section. But that seems to be that each head of a service shall, for a period, report to the minister, and the minister then, and to yourself, and then through the minister, it comes to you, the committee, in the form of the annual report. So there are different forms of report, to be quite honest. The annual report goes through the minister to the office. But isn't that in itself a contradiction? In terms, yeah. Because you are supposed to monitor the services. The minister is the accountable officer for the services. So you cannot be accountable to the minister. I mean, if you're there to conduct oversight over the services over which the minister has executive accountability, it's only in the narrower of possible interpretation that you report to the minister, am I correct? And that you basically report to the JCI, except where it specifically states in the Act that you need to report to the minister or the president.
This question?
I think I did, sir.
Okay.
Let me answer it in this way, Honorable Minister Schmidt. That in as far as I understand the law, is that I am accountable to this committee. That is beyond question. And accountable means that even the annual report must come here. Whether it comes through the minister or whatever, but it must end up here. So that for me is the bottom line. But, and I do understand that in the sense of accountability, I'm not accountable to the Minister of Intelligence. Of course, he may ask me to do certain things. I will then report on the basis of the task that he has asked me to perform. The law allows him to ask me to perform, to ask the Inspector General to perform certain tasks. And then I report in but if he then demands of me, or she demands of me, a report on matters that are not germane to the task that he has given me, I don't believe I'm duty bound to give those reports. It would be I would then maybe if push comes to shove, I would then have to come to the committee to ask for the assistance of the committee to whom I am accountable.
So it depends on the nature of the report, basically, yeah?
Yeah, sure. Yes, it does.
Yeah. Before we then say goodbye to you, just want to check some things here, just to ensure that I'm not confused, because at the moment I'm confused by your CV, page 6 of your CV. Now, you say there, in 1994, you joined the KwaZulu-Natal Provincial Legislature in 1994. And you served there until 2002. During that period, of course, you were first chief whip, then you became a chairperson of a portfolio committee, right? And then in 2000, you joined Siwendu Ngakane and Partners, where you were a professional assistant. And then you say somewhere, I suppose, reason for leaving Siwendu and then company. You say it is because you joined the KwaZulu-Natal Provincial Legislature full time. I was under the impression that when you came in 1994, you became a member of the provincial legislature. But in 2000, you say when you were leaving Siwendu and company, that it is because you wanted to join the KwaZulu-Natal provincial legislature full time. And then you say because you were working the two jobs concurrently, with the other one as chairperson of the portfolio committee. Do I understand you to be saying the following? 1994, you become an MDL. 2000, you find work with Siwe, Du, and others.
and there you are a professional assistant. Then you leave. It was possibly not even a year, because you went there in 2000 and you left sometime in 2000. Because you were an MPL as well as that professional assistant. Do I understand you to be saying that? And if you are saying that, I'm sure you would have declared this. In that effect, did you declare it?
Yeah, that is so, Honorable Chairperson. I joined the legislature in 1994. I was admitted as an attorney in 1999. I then tried to combine both legal practice and being a member of parliament. So I joined Siwendu, Ngakane and Partners. But it became impossible to do both. I had to choose between being in the legal practice and being in the legislature. At the time I chose being in the legislature. So I then resigned from Siwendu, Ngakane and Partners. Yes, I know. I did declare this. I did report to the chief whip and reported to the necessary structures about the work that I was doing outside the legislature.
I suppose when you say to the structures, it means that you made a disclosure in terms of the relevant act, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
Okay, is there anything else you would like to say as your parting shot, so to speak, to the committee?
No, I think all that I would have wanted to say, I said in my attempt to respond to the questions that the honourable members have put to me. All that I can say is that I'm honoured to have been given the opportunity to come to this and tell you. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Well, thank you for coming and to give us this opportunity to interact with you. Okay, thank you.
Remember, I love you.